Today's episode is part of a series in response to the COVID-19 outbreak. We'll be releasing a podcast every week that will help charities to A, navigate the rapid digital changes that, you know, have been thrust upon us, B, you know, hopefully set your charity up for digital going forward, and C, provide you with a platform for you to, you know, seek advice and share your stories. If you have any questions you'd like to ask us about how to be more digital, or if you'd like to share how your organisation has coped with the COVID-19 environment, reach out to us at podcasts@charitydigital.org.uk or follow the link in the description. Thanks and enjoy the pod.
Hello, it's Jonathan from Charity Digital and welcome to this week's pod. This is our seventh podcast since the COVID lockdown started. We know that many things have moved on really quickly for charities over the last month or so, and today we're going to be taking more of a forward-looking stance and looking at, as things start to settle, what charities can do to work towards the long term. We're still recording from our homes rather than our hipster Shoreditch studio, and so we apologise for any drop in sound quality. And today I'm joined by three speakers who are going to bring different perspectives based on their experience. First, we have Vicky Charles, Associate Director of Technology at Click Sargent.
Hello.
Next, we have Dr. Simon Davey. Simon is a change consultant.
Hello.
And then we have Barry Antwi, Technical Manager at Coopsys. Coopsys have a lot of charity clients, so it's going to be interesting to learn what Barry has been seeing happening in those organisations.
Hello.
So although the aim of this pod is to look forward, I think we should start by looking at where we are now and kick off with Vicky to tell us first what they've done at Click Sargent.
Okay. I think it's probably worth noting, first of all, that Click Sargent have invested quite heavily in digital technology over the last few years, and that put us in quite a good position for us to adapt our ways of working quite quickly. We've implemented a cloud-first approach. We've been using Office 365 and Skype extensively, and we've also introduced tools to enable remote access to all of our systems and platforms. And that's been really positive for us. But at the same time, we're also an organisation where we probably had about 60% of our workforce using fixed PCs and 40% laptops. So we then had to introduce additional laptops across the organisation really quickly. And that meant using all of our spare laptops, that meant leasing new laptops, and also where possible, encouraging staff to use their own personal devices. In addition to that, we've had to look at how we've used our resources externally. So we've moved all of our service delivery from being predominantly face-to-face to entirely digital. And this has included increased use of our live chat, using video conferencing with our families, obviously increased traffic to our website, and also trying to really develop and build on work we've done with Instagram and YouTube for our young people. Like every charity, we've been facing a drop in income. And so we're making use of as much virtual and digital fundraising opportunities as possible. Again, like every charity, we've launched our emergency appeal, but we've also been looking at where we can use platforms to take advantage of things like live streaming, which could be music, it could be gaming. We've also been doing pub quizzes. And in addition to that, we've been looking at how we take our online groups our face-to-face groups online. And that's been, for example, one of our social workers would run a face-to-face CrossFit session, which we now do online. And that's enabled us to continue supporting young people with their physical and emotional mental health and wellbeing. But it hasn't all been smooth sailing. We've learned a lot. You know, working at home one day a week is very different from working at home 7 days a week. And that's highlighted for us a skills gap with our staff in how they get the most out of accessing our systems remotely. It's also identified issues around accessing our systems. So we've had to look at reviewing and revising and reissuing all of our guides at pace. You know, in March alone, just the last 2 weeks in March, we took double the amount of support calls that we would take probably in a given month, all of which were about remote working. So it shows that we hadn't quite cracked that nut, so to speak. But it's given us an opportunity to really look at how we take things forward and how we look at, as an organisation, we start working in whatever the new world will be, because we know that it won't be the world that we've just come out of.
Lots of really brilliant points there, Vicky. I'm going to come back and build on quite a few of those, but what I'd like to do now is ask Barry to give his perspective as well from the multiple charity clients they work with at Coopsys.
So, yeah, lots of Vicky's points resonated with me. The first thing, probably the first word I can think of is a lot of panic from our clients, because they simply weren't ready for, you know, what was thrust upon us with COVID. So conversations around remote access, you know, over time were lost in the ether, because it wasn't seen as a priority, you know, because we can always go into the office. But what happened is, you know, no one was prepared. So there was a lot of provisioning of extra resources, you know, setting up new remote access systems, VPNs, remote desktop, where appropriate. There was even some clients that just didn't even have that infrastructure. So we had to think of workarounds. Like, we basically gave them parts of our remote access system so they can actually just log into their machines. Not the most elegant, but we had to find ways to get them to work. So it was quite a jumbled affair. We did experience a lot of service desk calls as well. You know, there's a huge number of calls during that initial period. Also, there was a lot of confusion as well, I found. So even if those systems were in place, staff didn't necessarily use them that regularly. So, you know, once they were jumping on, they were asking questions. Even if there was remote access guides for many, they may have not read them. You know, when you're in a blind panic, you just want to know how things work. It's easier just to phone someone and ask rather than reading through a guide. And probably the last thing I'd mention is maybe a bit of a disjointed experience for some clients. I say that because if you've got Office 365 and Teams and all those functions, a lot of the bits are there. So if you log into it and you feel like, oh, I can't necessarily work the way I would work, you know, human beings as they are, they find ways to adapt and probe new systems. And as a result, we had staff maybe using systems that weren't optimized for that way of working. So yeah, it was a very mixed bag, but a lot of things have settled now down since, but probably a bit more pre-planning would have been in order, you know, to help stem, you know, the chaos that ensued.
Yeah, so one of the points I want to pick up from what Vicky said was around some of the challenges of putting devices into people's hands. You know, they actually had to go into actually leasing equipment. Cost seems to be a really big issue at the moment. You know, we know that charities are suffering loss of income. It's actually something that we touched on in episode 17, which was called COVID and the elephants in the room. But this one for you in particular, I think, maybe, Simon. How can charities justify putting more often, you know, expensive kit in the hands of their staff?
I think for me, it's very much around understanding what's a cost and what's an investment. And if you think about the cost of running any kind of service or running any kind of organization, you've got three principal costs. You've got the cost of the staff, the salaries. You've got the cost of the desk and the space. And you've got the cost of the tech and the services. And I think my kind of rule of thumb on this is, if you start working out what an annual salary is divided by 220, 240 working days per year, that's obviously kind of quite substantial per working day. If you look at the cost of a desk and an office space, and I think the average, and particularly in London, is probably about kind of 5,000, so you're £5,000 a year. So you're probably looking at about £20 per working day for a bit of desk space. If you're talking about buying a laptop for, let's say, £660, and you use it every working day for 3 years, it's £1 a day. Now, if you're suddenly talking about buying hundreds of laptops at £660 each tomorrow, then that's obviously a huge hit on your cash flow. But for me, it's about kind of understanding whether there's any opportunities to invest and reduce the kind of frustrations, the lack of morale, and the limitations that old, poor, and outdated technology bring you. Because let's face it, if you're paying someone, whether it's 20, 30, 40, or £50,000 a year, and you're giving them a computer and you're wasting half an hour of their time per a day, that's a lot more expensive than technology spend.
Good. And I want to focus a little bit on what the learnings have been over the last, you know, 6 weeks or so. Don't know who wants to pick this up, but what have they been?
So obviously, like, you know, the big boys like the Amazons, you see they've functioned well in this environment. You know, they've thrived in it because they've got the online fulfillment to, you know, meet the demands, and, you know, there's less reliant on that contact. So for me, I think it's about basically thinking about how what charities deliver physically, how that can be transferred to the virtual. So trying to mapping out those services. And I don't necessarily think that, you know, the physical is going to be replaced totally, but it's trying to find out where those points are transferable, to basically keep their, you know, their clientele and their revenue streams going. I've also thought about the practical working, and the ability to adapt to change. So for me, when we basically go through these processes, it's a mad flurry of things, and we're trying to figure out how things work. And when those adaptions are in play, very often those learnings are lost, because people have gone through things, they've figured things out, and basically once those learnings are lost, I actually believe that's probably a real waste of valuable information. So for me, I think actually understanding what people went through and seeing how they adapted and how they functioned is really important to basically drive through any future changes in an organization. So I think trying to capture that, be it surveys or meetings or, I don't know, tickets logged, is a really important thing to really grasp.
How about you, Vicky?
I was just going to say, actually, whilst we did highlight a skills gap or knowledge gap more specifically, I think, as in something that you said, Barry, about understanding where the guides are and what elements will help them with their work, we've also noticed that actually that skills gap wasn't as wide as we thought, and staff actually feel that they've realised that they know more than they thought. So where we had staff who maybe considered themselves as being technophobes, for want of a better phrase, actually they've realised that all the skills that they use at home for online shopping or Facebook or whatever it is are just as applicable to the work environment. And I think that has given some staff a real confidence boost. And I think it's something that is almost linking back to that what's in it for me and really articulating that benefit for staff. I think that's something that's really important to take forward.
So I think one of my key questions, because I do want to make sure we're very forward-looking here, is to say, how do we build on what we've learned? Maybe you could give us some thoughts on that, Simon.
I mean, I think just echoing what Barry and Vicky were saying, I mean, change has definitely become easier within the COVID-19 crisis because, as Vicky was saying, the kind of mindsets of people who were struggling with things before and suddenly having to adapt and have adapted, and that's kind of worked really well. In terms of kind of building on what we've learned, I think part of this is about understanding what digital can and can't do, but also what it should and shouldn't do. And part of that process is understanding organizationally what our intentions and our outcomes are and being able to kind of clarify those, working out what the pain points are in the processes. So as Barry was saying earlier, being able to kind of prioritize, resolve and check up on those processes. I think that this degree of change is almost entirely unprecedented in any organization. Most organizations did a 2-year transformation program in about 2 weeks in terms of both services and the kind of way they operated. And the question is whether, not only how do we build on what we've learned, but whether we are willing to build on what we've learned and accept that we made some decisions that weren't quite right, and now the panic's settled down, but we know it's not quite right. How do we want to move forward?
I agree with that. It's very easy to just to revert to type, and you know, once you've gotten far past the mild panic, carry on and thinking things are business as usual. And if there's anything that's going to be a catalyst for change, it has to be this. We had a few clients basically wanting us to migrate them to SharePoint during this. Not the optimum time to do it, clearly. But for one particular client, we decided just to move their personal drives to OneDrive as a precursor to maybe a full SharePoint migration. So, you know, small baby steps. They understand how OneDrive works. They interact with it. Not as a significant impact. So it's those little baby steps that you can take to basically, you know, get people embedded into new systems and getting them understanding before you make the real major changes. So whether the catalyst is COVID or whatever business driver that you have in your organization, use it and basically enable it to move your organization forward.
It's also, though, an opportunity to really think about what's essential, what's needed right now. Mm-hmm. Likelihood is that we've gone through a period of time where there are things that maybe were important to service delivery before, or systems or platforms that we're not using now because maybe we don't have the resources for it, or, you know, or perhaps it's just not part of our current plans. And it gives us an opportunity, I think, as charities to really think about what we need going forward. And I'm not suggesting by any means that SharePoint isn't needed. I'm a massive fan of SharePoint and we use it quite extensively. But it could be that charities had planned it previously have coped without it. And so it may find that although it's important to them, it's not essential to their recovery.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's quite key for me from a leadership point of view is being able to, not only from a leadership point of view, from anybody who's involved in a charitable organisation, is to just acknowledge the messiness of all this and the fact that we're making, as long as we're clear what our intentions and outcomes are, we're making a lot of decisions on the fly. Some of those decisions will be wrong. And we really need our leaders to be able to kind of hold the space and acknowledge the messiness and acknowledge that we're going to get things wrong. But in getting things wrong, we will also learn from the process as well, much as we learn from kind of getting things right. I think that's going to be absolutely key in having really effective, sustainable organizations delivering great services in the future.
Good. Lots of really great points there. When I was when we were chatting about this a couple of days ago, one of the other topics that came up a few times was training. And I guess whilst we've seen staff in many cases exhibit a greater level of self-reliance than maybe was expected, there was still a sense that, you know, maybe as organizations, we often underinvest in training our staff to actually make the most out of our investments in technology. I think this was particularly one of your points, Barry. Would you like to kind of explain more about that?
Yeah, so there's various ways you can train. Obviously, there's the face-to-face, there's user guides, there's videos. We've used various methods. So for a 365 migration, we'd have a few days training, hand-holding, getting people used to the systems, you know, getting a feel, you know, answering those questions so they feel comfortable before, you know, such a big change. But also there's a cost to that as well. So it's balancing it all out. So yes, we do need to train our staff, but there needs to be a balance between that and a bit of self-sufficiency as well, because you can't hold everyone's hand all the time. So I think it just needs to be balanced and measured. So as long as, you know, you've put a reasonable amount of time in there and you've thought about the resources and your audience and what they need, I think that's the main thing. Mm. And obviously that continual feedback as well, because what you may feel is a good training program may not quite work, but it's taking those inputs in and using them in the right way to develop, you know, how you deliver these services going forward.
And that comes back to that question we talked about, cost and value, a little earlier, doesn't it? And I kind of think of this as a sort of scaffolding process. We need to be clear about our needs. We need to be clear about the tools that we use, the functionality and our ability to use it. Because whilst training is expensive and you don't want to over-engineer your training, you don't want to spend too much money on it, if people cannot genuinely do the things that they need to do, whether that's around information management, communications, or delivering services, because they're not equipped to be able to use the tool, then the tool itself starts to become completely redundant.
Agreed.
So I think one of the other things I was concerned about is that maybe in the rush to take services online, to get everybody working from home, you know, some things might have been done which, you know, in the ideal world, you wouldn't have gone down that route. You'd have gone in a different direction. How should charities kind of recover in those situations? You know, what type of things, maybe another one for you, Barry, what types of things have you seen organisations do that you would now be saying, well, when you get the time, you should go back and do this to put yourself in a better position for the longer term?
So you've got the whole clients will on a traditional file server environment. Maybe that system or the remote access to it didn't have enough licensing requirements or resourcing enough for all these users to be simultaneously on a system at the same time. So what do they do? They adapt. They say, okay, I'm on Office 365. I can use Teams. I can share documents this way. And what do you have? You have information sprawl. You've got bits of information in different places. And, you know, needs must, you know, they had to do it to basically work. But it's also just realizing that actually there's actually going to be a cleanup exercise to rationalize all that information. Because if you've got the information in two different places, then there's a challenge around that. So as Simon's mentioned, you know, it's basically accepting that things are messy and realizing there's going to be some backfill. You're going to have to go back on yourself and do the correct exercises if that's the path you want to take. And obviously, as Vicky has mentioned as well, like maybe SharePoint isn't the right platform, so it needs to be, you know, appropriate for the organization. But hypothetically, if that's where you're going, then that exercise is needed to rationalize all that data and bring it back. So data sets, how big's your data, you know, videos, you want to consolidate all that information. There's lots of basically strict requirements to basically migrate your data to Office 365, and all those tasks cannot be skipped over because you'll be in a lot of pain if you don't basically do that pre-work in advance.
Vicky, have you got anything to add to that?
I think it's been mentioned, but I think just really engage your staff. Your staff will be the first ones to tell you if something doesn't work. And I think for us, the approach we're trying to take now is, let's not get out something that's perfect because it would take too long. Let's just push something out to our staff, even if it's a set of guidance, be really honest and say, this is our first iteration. If it doesn't work for you, tell us. Tell us how to make it better. And just go with that kind of approach. And I think that fundamentally, as I think Simon's mentioned a few times, we're going to make a lot of mistakes as we go through this process, but if we're really open and transparent with our staff, they'll accept that. And in fact, they'll like you more for it.
Yeah, good points.
I think there's a lot to be said for that kind of honesty and trying things and openness and transparency. A couple of things that making me slightly nervous alongside Barry's points about data and information management, which is just something which will need to be kind of worked through, are issues around compliance and security. And it's interesting how the ICO in particular have reduced some of the restrictions on compliance and also been producing some really good guides into how organisations can operate more flexibly within COVID-19. But I guess there's also challenges about security, because sometimes if your systems don't quite work and enable you to share and do what you want to do, because you weren't in as well, and you hadn't planned, and you weren't in an advanced position as ClickSergeant is, Vicky. I guess there's challenges about to what extent people are maybe kind of stretching security a little bit. And I think that will be a test, particularly for a lot of smaller organizations in the future, that there will be compliance slip-ups, but there will be security slip-ups. And I'm not aware of anything particularly serious or dangerous at the moment, but there may be some things that need to be patched up and resolved as we kind of move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we've issued new guidance to our staff about protecting data at home. Because we see this as a time when potentially charities and lots of other organisations are at their most vulnerable in terms of cyber attacks because our focus is elsewhere. Not saying that we're not thinking about cyber security. Yeah. It's not our primary concern right now. I mean, I think we are taking the approach that in terms of ICA, for example, we welcome the fact that they've perhaps relaxed their stringent approach to data protection, but actually we haven't changed our approach because we think that any time, data security is just as important. And even more so now, we need to be trying to keep more an eye on it because actually with staff working at home, there are so many potential opportunities, I suppose, to just not quite get it right. So whether that's storing information on your C drive or leaving information printed out or having phone calls overheard by other people. And of course, we can't mitigate against all of those things. But, you know, there is the opportunity to just keep issuing that guidance to staff, keep reminding them of their own accountabilities versus kind of the organisational accountabilities and just keep monitoring that.
Yeah, those are good points. We do a lot of work with the National Cybersecurity Centre, and they've been very concerned, particularly about the rise in bad actors using kind of phishing attacks based on COVID to try and gain information. And whereas some of the devices might have been secure when people were working in the office, devices at home may not be secure. And, you know, one of the things I would say is think about how you can extend some of that security at really very low cost in real terms to some of those devices.
I think there's a couple of really significant human factors that come into security when people who aren't used to working from home and maybe don't have the luxury of a bit of protected space from working from home in situations like this. And I think Vicky's already alluded to kind of the potential for kind of leaving a printed document lying around. Now, that might be a confidential organisational document with limited implications. It might actually be something that relates to child safeguarding or a vulnerable person, in which case the severity of kind of leaving it lying around is much more significant. I think the other thing is just kind of who's in the space. So I know we all should lock our devices down the moment we kind of leave them to go and make a cup of coffee or go for a bathroom break, but not everyone does all the time. And in the office, that may or may not be okay. But if you're sharing a building either with your family and you've got children or you have flatmates and they suddenly have access to your entire information repository, you might have the most secure system in the world, but if you walked away from your computer without locking it, then that's a human factor that no technical security can provide for.
Just wanted to mention something, just being a bit of a computer nerd and a geek, there's some really cool features in Office 365 that can enhance security piece that you just need to get the right licensing and switch on. There's identity protection, you know, conditional access. So based on different policies, you can, you know, depending on your personal machine or a corporate machine, you can control how that data is presented. But yeah, as Simon has said, you know, the human factor is always going to come into play as well. So So it's a balance between both.
Some really good points there. Want to just keep moving us along. Got a couple more areas want to briefly touch on. So one of the areas Charity Digital we've been really concerned about is those who are digitally excluded, and in particular low-income families who maybe don't have access to technology. Although we in general are pleased to see more digital services, we're worried about how charities are looking after those people to ensure they still have access. What are your thoughts on that, Victoria?
It's interesting, actually. I think I was having a conversation with someone about this earlier this morning. We know that we have a number of families who don't have access to laptops, tablets, PCs. We know that. For the most part, though, most families tend to have mobile phones, although the level of functionality on a mobile phone vary from family to family, obviously. What we've found is we've approached corporates who have supported us in the past. to try and help us with devices for those families that need that additional support. And we've had some very generous corporates. I mean, one in particular has donated a number of iPads. We've also looked, we've got links to other charities that might support families with mobile phones and SIM cards. But I think that it is a challenge. My overriding feeling tends to be that we should try and meet their needs. So rather than looking at, well, we use Skype because we know that Skype is not used by any families and young people, you know, we would look to use technology that kind of helps meet their needs. So if it's a case that they don't have tablets or mobile phones, then we'll use WhatsApp or we'll use text messaging. Before anybody mentions, we do know that there are some less than advantageous terms around the use of WhatsApp. We have quite stringent guidance on how to use it. And also telephone calls. I mean, I think it's important that we don't go so far with digital that we forget the primary means of communications that often families can use.
Good. Yeah, lots of great points there. Anybody got anything to add to that?
Just echoing bits what Vicky said in terms of, you know, many have mobile phones now. They may not be the shiniest or the newest or the greatest, but they have a browser. So thinking about how you present that content on those phones, making sure, you know, websites and apps are compatible, just to give them the best means to gain access to those services, I think is a must.
Good. So we're just about out of time now. So I want to wrap with one last question. So the latest kind of sounds coming through the press from the government channels are that we're going to start to see some elements of relaxation of lockdown in the not too distant future, maybe even by the time this is published. But we're still going to see a lot of restrictions. We're still going to see, you know, we're going to be required to provide socially distanced workspaces, which means lots of people aren't going to be in the office. Travel's still going to be difficult, I think. So it's still going to be important to think about, you know, what are the steps that charities can be making, particularly over the next year, that are going to be moving them forward, but moving them forward in a way that will help them in the long term as well. I was wondering what each of you would recommend in that area. What steps should a charity be taking over the rest of this year?
For me, it's really evaluating how they work. And those steps, maybe there's more capacity now since, you know, there's more working from home. I'm not sure. Hopefully there is, because very often when you're stuck in the operational and you're so busy, you know, the strategic or the thoughts around how you work rather than how you work aren't really considered because you're so busy. So I'm hoping that there's more capacity now to really think around those things, like getting data champions for each department to see how the information is organized. You know, many systems I come across haven't really been looked at for years, you know, and maybe it's time for a refresh. And that work will never be wasted, because ultimately whatever you decide to go do in the future, you'll be more ready once you've done that exercise.
I think for me, it's about, we mentioned this earlier, being clear about your intentions, your outcomes and your principles. So you're investing the effort in the right direction. Look at what's working and not working, not only in your own organization, but other organizations, because there's so many organizations doing great new innovative things and adapting in ways that we couldn't probably have imagined 2 or 3 months ago. I think there's something about mapping the resources, the tools, the skills and experiences you need and working out how you're going to resource it. There's something about embracing the appetite for change, but building a menu of change and how it's served. I think of Zoom as a bit like pizza. I don't want pizza every day. And I think finally, we need to slaughter the sacred cows. We shouldn't evermore be saying we always did it this way and that's okay. Things have changed. We need to roll with that change. And whilst COVID isn't exactly an opportunity, I think COVID has provided an environment for us to adapt, and those adaptations could be positive in many ways for our services.
So to add to both of what you've said, who I think have probably covered it off quite comprehensively, I think I would just say this is a chance for charities to continue their collaborative working. I think that's something really quite unique to the charity sector, in that there's always such a strong willingness to work together. And as you mentioned, Simon, about sharing best practice, but it also means that there's an opportunity to look outside of your own organisation for support. So whether that's your corporates or other charity partners, or whether that's pro bono support, I think it's just an opportunity for organisations to support each other in this environment, because actually all of the charity sector are facing very similar issues, irrespective of the size. And there are probably going to be a lot of opportunities for us to learn from what each other's doing and work together on taking forward projects and programmes that are going to really support us.
Absolutely, yeah.
Good. Well, thank you very much. That's all we've really got time for today. I think we've had a really fascinating discussion and some really positive forward-looking points, which was really what we were looking to do today. You know, we've been trying to help charities take the short-term steps, but we want to now try and provide the guidance for people to be able to consolidate that and use that for the long term. So thank you very much, Vicky, Simon and Barry. That's been really helpful. And thank you for all of us for joining us, and hope to speak to you again soon. Thank you and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.